How is Paul Ryan playing in his home district these days? Craig Gilbert went there to find out. Over in Madison, Jason Stein reports on how lawmakers are dealing with the wave of sexual harassment allegations inundating many top politicians. And in Milwaukee, Alderman Tony Zielinski has made it official. He's taking on Mayor Tom Barrett in the 2020 race. What are his chances? All that and more from the best political reporting team in Wisconsin today on Politics. Well, good afternoon. I'm David Haynes. I'm the opinions editor at the Journal Sentinel, and welcome to On Politics for this November 30th. Well, we spoke with Craig Gilbert earlier today about a trip he took back to Paul Ryan's district to see how people are treating Paul Ryan these days in Janesville and beyond. Let's talk to Craig. So, Craig, welcome back to On Politics. You were in Washington today, but you were in back in Wisconsin in Paul Ryan's district. And talk a bit about what you found when you did some reporting down there.
Well, people have definitely kind of polarized over Paul Ryan. You know, what's interesting about him is in the past, he's a Republican who's often got a lot of Democratic votes. There were a lot of people that didn't agree with him on the issues, but kind of liked him and thought he was a good guy. That a lot of that has disappeared because of his speakership with Republicans in control and because of President Trump, who's a very polarizing figure, and Paul Ryan, who had criticized Trump during the campaign of 2016, has been much more supportive speaker, obvious political reasons, but that has really kind of lowered his esteem among non-Republicans, among those kind of moderates and liberals and Democrats who kind of liked him as, you know, despite his Republican Party affiliation right before. And so there's a lot more polarization. And the other thing that struck me is that people, you know, really get in his constituents really sort of get the box he's in politically as speaker with Trump as president. They kind of get the fact that, you know, Trump isn't really his guy, and they get the fact he's kind of trying to walk a tightrope. But for some people, that's sort of okay, and they kind of maybe even sympathize with his position. But for others, it has changed the way they view him because they feel so strongly about President Trump that they, you know, they will never vote for him again.
Yeah. So how do you think this plays in 2018? He has a fairly strong challenger. What would have to happen for Paul Ryan to be in any real trouble for re-election?
Yeah, well, if you go back to 2012 when he was on the ticket, he had his kind of lowest victory margin ever, but it was still 12 points. And people had polarized over him because he was on the ticket with Mitt Romney a lot in that race, and it still wasn't enough for him to lose. So it's not enough for people to be polarized. It's not enough for him to kind of lose whatever Democratic support he had before. But there would have to be, I think, some real turnout impacts. I mean, you'd have to have some Republican voters be maybe demoralized enough about either Congress or President Trump to not turn out at the same levels as Democrats. And then you'd have to have, obviously, a lot of independents swinging against Ryan. So it would take a lot, a given, because the district is a Republican district. It was carried by Mitt Romney in 2012, even in a year when Romney lost by 7 points statewide, and Donald Trump carried it by 10 points. So it would still take a special set of circumstances to really put him in peril.
And we probably should point out that Ryan did much better than Trump in his district in 2016.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, of course, he didn't have a really strong opponent, so you have to discount that a little bit. But what's interesting about Paul Ryan's district is, you know, if there's sort of a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, there are parts of Paul Ryan's district that are more kind of Ryan Republican, which is, you know, I would say in the suburbs around Milwaukee and Waukesha and closer to Lake Michigan. And then there are parts, the more rural parts and a little bit maybe west of the highway, that are a little bit more Trump Republican, and where Paul Ryan was getting a lot of pushback during the campaign when he was criticizing Trump. So there's an interesting kind of wrinkle within his district just among Republican voters, and that's part of the tightrope he's walking.
So I know you didn't go down there to report this, but what kinds of things did you hear about Trump in Ryan's district?
Well, you know, both in the trips I've taken to southwestern Wisconsin and southeastern Wisconsin, even talking to Trump voters, you know, nobody really likes the tweet. I mean, nobody really likes, well, some people do, but most people, and even a considerable number of Trump voters, are kind of disconcerted by his behavior and his sort of communication style and his language and rhetoric. Some of those people are just trying to work their way through that. And some of them are diehard, hardcore supporters. But, you know, it's kind of wait and see for some people. I mean, even on the tax issue that is coming to a head in Congress, I mean, it, again, on both trips, it sort of struck me that this is not like a front burner issue for a lot of people. I didn't hear a great clamor for a tax bill, and a lot of people still don't really know exactly what's in it. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that particular debate plays out going into the election cycle, because one of the dynamics in Ryan's race is going to be, you know, whether people like or don't like the policies that that a Republican president or Republican Congress are generating.
All right. Well, Craig Gilbert, thanks so much.
All right. Till next time.
So now we're back in our Milwaukee studio with Mary Spicuzza, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Dan Bice, a columnist. And let's talk a little bit about Ryan's opponent, Randy Bice, some news on him in recent days.
Sure. There are actually two Democrats running. But Randy Bice is probably the Democrats' best hope for knocking off Paul Ryan. He's gotten a lot of attention nationally. Just this week, he got a very positive profile in Newsweek, mm-hmm. in which they said that he's the type of candidate that would help the Democrats get control of the working class again. And a lot of these things are focused on his bio. We've been looking more at some of the details about him. I wrote last week about how he had not paid child support in a couple. He had fallen behind on his child support. Mm-hmm. Didn't catch up for a couple of years and eventually paid that off after he got in the race. And then more recently, he had a loan that he took out in 2002 to buy a car, and he never paid it back. It took him 15 years. And so it went from a $1,700 loan, and it eventually he ended up paying $4,300 plus interest, mm-hmm. including interest and so forth. So, and obviously Republicans have been happy to respond to that. Interestingly, today, Bryce sent out a fundraiser using that story to say, I'm one of you, I have financial problems, please give me money with this campaign. So he might be a different kind of Democrat, but he does know how to handle controversy.
Yeah. So Craig talked about Mary in his spot about how Ryan is probably may not get as many of Democrats or independents as in the past, but mm-hmm. he's still really strong. Randy Bice, How do you think he's playing so far, even given the problems that Dan has talked about?
I think he's certainly gotten a lot of national attention, certainly more than the other Democrat hoping to unseat Ryan, Kathy Myers. I've seen him with celebrities smiling in photos all over Twitter. So he's certainly doing a very good job of getting his name out there and
union
getting attention.
Union angle in a union area? Or
sure, and his viral, his stuff. Announcement video went viral of kind of a, you know, working class person from the district trying to unseat Paul Ryan, saying Ryan is out of touch.
And Paul Ryan's primary opponent last time was someone who ran a national campaign but didn't run a very strong local one. That'll be the difference here, even mm-hmm. though Randy's getting a lot of money, $1.4 million in the last quarter, which was more than what Paul Ryan got. He got $1.1 million. I'm sure he can get more if he wants to. The thing is, he needs to run a campaign that's both national, getting the money, and playing off the fact that Paul Ryan is very unpopular nationally with an approval rating in the 20s. To take that and to bring in money, but he's got to build a strong local campaign, and that's what we've not seen yet.
And Ryan has tended to do very well in his reelection bids and has
he's
had
done very well.
And Randy's run before for various offices and lost every time. So, you know, the big question is, can he do something different this time?
All right, let me ask you both real quick, and then we need to move on. But what would be a sign from Paul Ryan that he's taking this seriously?
I think if we start a lot of opposition research, a lot of he tends to not really acknowledge his opponents too much.
Right.
So I would think that if he starts criticizing Bryce or trying to face that head on, or
and it's funny because Bryce has been accusing Paul Ryan of leaking those stories to us about that. But I haven't talked to the Ryan campaign at all. The first they knew about any of these stories is when they appeared. But I think. You know, and they would probably prefer that these stories come out 8 months from now, not right now.
Right,
but
right,
I think the opposition research, and then secondly, you know, there's been criticism that Ryan has not done many town halls. He's not really gotten down on the ground, talked to people.
So if we start seeing him show up a little
more. He did that CNN town hall, which was obviously not a typical.
But I think if he's doing a more traditional meet and greets with people, then you're starting to think, okay, he thinks there's a little bit of an issue.
All right, so let's move on to another issue that is really engulfing the whole country. The sexual harassment allegations, and we'll talk more about that with Mary and Dan in a minute. But I spoke with Jason Stein about how the legislature is reacting to those allegations. So, Jason, welcome to On Politics.
Well, thank you, David. Good to be on.
So I wanted to talk to you about the discussions in the legislature this week regarding sexual harassment. There were some new trainings. There's a lot of discussion about the current policy. What's going on there, both in the Assembly and the State Senate?
Absolutely. So, you know, it goes without saying that we're in the midst of a really deep and profound national reckoning over this issue, and the legislature is trying to grapple with it as well. So there's more training being done of the existing standards, and journalistic organizations are, you know, asking for findings of past cases of sexual harassment or other types of discrimination within the legislature as a workplace. And that has sort of sparked this debate over, you know, when those findings should be public.
Right. And so the Assembly had some required training of staff this week, right?
Correct. And the Senate is considering, I think, not just considering, but I think in the process of doing the same thing. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. And the Assembly leader, Robin Voss, Speaker Robin Voss, has said that allegations of sexual harassment are not going to be made public. What's his reasoning there, and what's been the pushback?
Right. And it's not just Robin Voss. Gordon Hinds, the Democratic leader in the Assembly, and both Senator Fitzgerald and Schilling, the Democrat, top Democrat and Republican in the Senate, they've all come down to basically the same response, which is that we don't want to reveal victims' identities, and therefore we're not ever going to reveal any findings of sexual harassment or other discrimination within the legislature. They feel that even with redacting victims' names and identifying information, that because the legislature is relatively small workplace, that it might indirectly identify victims. So they're saying, you know, basically no disclosure under any circumstance.
Well, under any circumstances, what if, let's
say... Yeah, I think that's right.
What if, let's say, a victim came forward and said, I choose to be identified and want to talk about this?
Right. Well, so obviously, you know, it's a free country and you can't prohibit people from coming forward and talking about their experiences. And, you know, at least one of the leaders, Jennifer Schilling, said that she would support any victim that came forward and do that. You know, what I'm trying to find out, though, is would the victims have access to the findings of these reports?
Right.
Because, you know, obviously, it's one thing to come out and say, I experienced this. It's another thing to have an official finding that agrees with you and backs up and supports what you're saying.
And has there been pushback from, say, open government advocates about this decision?
There's definitely been pushback from transparency organizations like the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. And I would not limit it to that. You've certainly seen some attorneys who represent victims of sexual harassment in the workplace say themselves that, you know, while they want to see victims' names and identities protected, saying that they're, you know, this hasn't been uniform view of people in that sector, but many people that represent victims in some form are saying that they also think that there should be room for transparency and questioning whether keeping these allegations and findings secret, whether that hurts, whether that helps victims, or whether it ultimately, you know, puts more women in a vulnerable spot going forward.
Right. All right, Jason. Well, we appreciate your reporting on that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So now I'm back with Mary and Dan. And Mary, let's talk about some more news today, this week, out of City Hall. Tony Zielinski, alderman, is in the race for mayor. Yep. So what does that mean? What are his chances?
So he got in very early, like more than 2 years in advance. Yeah. The mayor just won re-election in April 2016, so this is 2020. I think that also I was looking back in our clips and I realized Bob Donovan got in about 2 years in advance too. So it seems like there is precedent for getting in this early. You know, he basically has been very critical of the mayor on public safety issues, very critical of the cuts to police and the numbers of police and firefighters. He's been pushing for greater lead transparency in terms of lead poisoning, lead pipes. He's been pushing a cops house initiative to have kind of cops houses in troubled neighborhoods to increase police presence and community relations. But mainly he is also extremely against the streetcar and has been hitting the mayor repeatedly over the streetcar, saying it's another sign that the mayor is too focused on downtown and not focused enough on the neighborhood, saying that he doesn't budget appropriately, and that the mayor should be focused on public safety and not the streetcar or the trolley.
Okay, so Zielinski's in. Mm-hmm. Who else might get in?
Well, before we skip over this, one important reason that he might be announcing now is, as a candidate, as an alderman candidate, the most money he can receive from a donor is $787. As a mayoral candidate, he can take $6,000 per person or per PAC or whatever. So he has put $100,000 from his own pocket into the race. Mm-hmm. It still looks like the mayor has more than $600,000. So there's still a wide gap, and he said at his press conference yesterday that he's going to be open to putting more money in.
More of his own money.
But it was also interesting that even though he's been talking about running and people knew he was likely to run, mm-hmm. how he lacked specifics at this thing yesterday. When we talk about streetcar, people are like, "When are you going to end it?" He says yes, but he doesn't give a time. When asked what's he going to do with streetcars, with the rail lines and stuff, he didn't have a plan for that. When asked how many cops he'd like to see, there are a little more than 1,500 cops on the street and at Milwaukee Police Department now. He didn't have a number, said he didn't know when he would have a number or how he'd pay for more cops. So, but maybe over the next 2.5 years, he'll be able to flesh that out.
Well, on Zielinski or any other candidate, it's not just money, right? It's political organization. Barrett
right.
has how many terms he's been in. He's got an organization.
Well, he had a fundraiser.
You've got to build that if you want to beat him.
He had a fundraiser in early November. 200 people showed up. Yeah. And, I mean, that's a pretty impressive thing. Ashanti Hamilton, the Common Council president, had a fundraiser 2 days before that. He had 25 or 30 people, which for him was good, mm-hmm. but it's not 200.
There's certainly been speculation that Ashanti Hamilton would be interested in running for mayor. Also, there's been questions about whether Lena Taylor would want to run for mayor or maybe city attorney. So I don't think he's necessarily the only person eyeing a run, but I think I think people realized he was 100% in before this announcement and that he was hell bent on running this time.
But I don't think Ashanti, and maybe this could change, but I don't think right now Ashanti would run. Ashanti Hamilton would run if Mayor Barrett ran for re-election.
He may be looking at the long ball of 2024.
Well, he's still a young guy, and I think he could be doing, you know, he's got time to build up his support. But, you know, Tony says he's going to be out. He's not going to run for alderman again. And in fact, endorsed Milwaukee County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievich to replace him. Mm-hmm. And when I asked her if she was in the race already, she said she's actually looking at re-election for the county board. But it does sound like there have been discussions between the two of them. Yeah. And it's interesting because
you make more at the city.
Probably almost three times as much as an alderman. But it sounds like discussions have already happened and that she's planning to run for his seat.
So if there are others who might jump in, presumably would they do it fairly soon, given the fact that it might take the time to build the organization and the money if you're really serious about it?
Well, it's true that the mayor's run very well in the last three elections.
Right. For mayor, not so good for governor.
Not so much.
But, you know, if he said he's not running for re-election, it would be like 2004 when we had 10 or 11 candidates in. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would jump in then. If he's running for re-election, not so much.
I mean, any reason to think he's not running?
He's not given any indication that he's not running. I mean, I would be surprised. This would be his fifth term that he'd be running for, so I would think it would be capped off after this one. I can't imagine him running for a sixth
Milwaukee
term.
Likes but
Milwaukee mayor should have, at least five. Yeah,
right. We do have mayors for life, or have had in the past.
Pretty much.
So, but yeah, I have not gotten any indication that he is not running, but he has not declared his reelection either, but it's early, so he has some time.
All right, well, let's move on to our favorite time of the show.
Winners, losers.
Winners and losers. Dan, I want to start with you first. Who's your winner?
My winner was Foxconn. They cleared another hurdle this week with Racine County approving the sale of bonds for them, even though the vote and the action is going to cost Racine County and its bond rating, which has already dropped. It's an important hurdle for Foxconn, and obviously it looks like it's on
its
way.
So is the bond rating thing just sort of something that happens, or is that something we should be
It's not a major downgrade. It was just one tick, but it is interesting that Wall Street isn't looking on this just as an incredibly positive thing, because the amount of money that's being given is an incredible amount of money, both by the state and by the community.
All right. So who is your loser?
Actually, following up on what Jason was talking about, the fact that Robin Voss said that preemptively he won't release the results of any investigations of sexual harassment by members of the assembly. That's, you know, the fact that we know of one case in particular with the former majority leader who was, who was accused of sexual harassment and eventually was removed from office as a result of that. The fact that we can't get the results of that investigation, I think it's just somewhat crazy that we can't get that.
And the legislature has a long history of redacting information, so they could redact any victims' names, identifying information. I mean, they could redact everything except for the name of the person being accused. And the fact that they aren't releasing anything, as one person I talked to said, it raises questions about whether they're trying to protect the victim or protect the lawmaker of their own
behavior.
It sounds
a lot like Congress, legislative bodies that want accountability for everybody but themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was bipartisan lack of accountability.
Right.
All right, Mary, so who's your loser of the week?
I'm going to say Matt Lauer, who was fired recently from the Today Show. He was making, what, $20 to $25 million a year, and apparently used his power to prey on young staffers or colleagues, and clearly there was a unequal position when it came to power, and that he also seems to have had like a button on his desk to lock his door, and there were some very disturbing accounts of his behavior, the woman who passed out in his office. It's really upsetting, and it's especially disappointing when you keep hearing about these high profile men in media, and then, you know, I think we all know people who have left the field due to budget cuts and things like that, and you think like, how does somebody like this get away with it for so long and make so much money as they prey upon women?
So on that point, if the story is correct, the woman who passed out in his office, this was 2001, I believe.
And she was in her 40s
had
at the
to be
time.
Taken to the NBC nurse for treatment. So NBC knew all about this.
So they say they didn't, and they say there wasn't a complaint.
Well, they say, they're very careful to say current management.
Current management, yes. So that makes
a question
understand. About
That's
previous management.
That's a very lawyerly way to
Yes,
to
but in previous management, no. And it does sound like there were other women who have complained about him or come forward since then. Right. So I would be very curious about that timeline of who knew what when, because clearly some people knew about it.
But even if they hadn't filed complaints with Human Resources, it's true that Variety magazine has been looking for 2 months at this issue. I'm sure word would get around. Megyn Kelly said she had heard about this as well. Mm-hmm. Word would get around that this was going on. New York Times more recently was looking into it.
So Variety had asked NBC for comment, so they clearly knew something was coming, which might have been why they didn't suspend him while during an investigation and promptly fired him. So, but yeah, it makes you wonder what people knew and how long.
But it's not just him. I mean, this
it.
Week's been crazy.
Oh, yeah, Garrison Keillor from Minnesota Public Radio, Russell Simmons. Yeah, there have been quite a few. So it used to seem like this was kind of coming out at maybe once a day, or now it's like, I think
it's
we have three.
Hourly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So That's a very dreary topic, obviously. But who's your winner?
Yeah, I'm going to say Pokemon Go. They might get $83,000 from Milwaukee County over this to settle a lawsuit over trying to regulate like virtual reality games in the Milwaukee County parks. Milwaukee County tried to crack down on Pokemon, and you know, a very popular game. It apparently gets people out walking a lot. I don't play it, but they're out walking all over. So maybe it's like good for Milwaukee's health. But it is apparently not a good idea.
Unless they're in your backyard.
Right. Yeah, that would be a little crazy. But apparently it is not, it's a tough thing to regulate when you are a county park. So if they get $83,000 for that, that will... you know, in tough budget times.
We should have done loser.
There were
today.
A lot of losers. I was having trouble.
You were struggling. All right. Well, let's to continue our discussion about the sexual harassment allegations. We have a couple of questions related to that. Andrew asks, in our story yesterday that you worked on, Mary,
mm-hmm.
on
with Jason
Stein, on the way the legislature's handling sexual harassment policy. He basically says, I think any accuser should be identified once an accusation is made. Shouldn't the accuser be identified, questioned, and so forth? Hmm. So why wouldn't that happen? Talk about sort of why journalists wouldn't do it, but mm-hmm. also as part of the process at the legislature.
Okay. So the legislature isn't identifying or isn't releasing any information. They're not releasing the accused. They're not releasing the accuser. I think a lot of people have raised questions about whether there's some kind of medium between all or nothing. For our purposes as journalists, we tend to not name accusers, especially in sexual assault, sexual harassment. They can choose to self-identify where they would come forward and be named, but we don't tend to out people.
The victim.
Out the victim. Keep in mind that these are complaints that were filed with HR, you know, or the legislature, and that a lot of the time they want to have anonymity while they're filing because they don't want to have a chilling effect where no one comes forward.
You know, we actually had a case of sexual harassment with the majority leader, Bill Cramer, in 2014, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did the stories, we did not identify the two women that he allegedly harassed at the beginning, but what became interesting is that as this went around, there was another individual who actually was, I mean, that was a physical assault.
Mm-hmm.
She ends up eventually going public and explaining what happened with her, and he ends up getting charged with felonies as a result of that. So we use the names only when the victim decided to identify herself.
All right, so another question from Lauren, and she wants to know, what's the latest on the allegations against President Trump? Who made them? Are they believable? And why haven't these women had anything to say since the election? Mary, you want to take that?
Sure. So they actually have, some of them have. There was a, you know, was it 11 women? And like
10 to 12, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and they, you know, many of them spoke out before the campaign. They have since actually, some of them have spoken out and said in the wake of Weinstein and other allegations that they feel like they were kind of forgotten and brushed aside, and that whereas these other men are facing consequences of losing their jobs or being fired, that Donald Trump was still elected president despite their allegations. So are they true? There have been, you know, a number of women who have come forward. I have not seen any indication that any of them were false claims. Obviously, the president has denied them and said that he, you know, that they're not true, except for like the Access Hollywood tape where it was his voice. He's since questioned whether it was his voice, but I think everybody agrees that it was his voice where he talked about assaulting.
And a lot of people have noted the response in the media in Hollywood, where a number of these people who have been accused get fired pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the politicians, even when there are multiple accusers, are tending to hang on or stay on for a longer period of time. Just today we have Nancy Pelosi calling for Representative Conyers to mm-hmm. step down, but still it's been a much slower process. You know, with Al Franken, again, you know, the question is, how many accusers do you have to have before you step down?
There's different kinds of accountability, though.
It is.
They're accountable to voters, right, and to the electorate and the political process.
And the media has a trust issue. You have to be able to...
Credibility.
Right. And if you're, you know, and looking back, the interview by Matt Lauer with Bill O'Reilly is just, you know, just insane, given what we all know apparently what was going on.
Or the Anne Hathaway interview where paparazzi photographed her and he... had a very condescending tone of what have you learned from this, like it was her fault. That
he couldn't have done either of those things with this in the background. So you're right, there's a trust issue and accountability issue, but it's funny that the political process actually slows this down instead of speeding up the accountability here.
And I think victims, when it comes to politicians, do feel like politicians aren't necessarily held as accountable as they would have been in the private
sector. It can take time. If you remember the Bob Packwood case some years ago, that took 2 years for it to wind its way through the process.
But even a Roy Moore victim recently said that she felt like she was defending herself, saying she's not a liar, and saying that she felt like she was being personally attacked for coming forward and really doubled down on her allegations.
And there's a really good chance he wins. I mean, it's still in the air, but, you know, so, you know, what sort of accountability is there? It'll be interesting.
All right, so that's our show for this week. I want to thank Dan, Mary, Craig Gilbert, Jason Stein, our producer Bill Schultz, and, of course, all of you for watching. I'm David Haynes with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for tuning in.